to begin.
May it please the court. My name is David Patinos. My registration number is 35732. With me is Jeffrey Anderson. His registration number is 14907. And we represent Daniel T. Long, who's the plaintiff and appellant in this matter. In this appeal, we're asking this court to enforce a settlement agreement that the party signed in October 2010 in a manner that's consistent with the intention of the parties when they signed that agreement. And there are four things that we're asking this court for today. The first is to find that the eastern end of the easement does not terminate at the northeast corner of Mr. Long's property, but at a point about 80 feet east. The second thing that we're asking for is that this court find that the defendants are obligated to prepare a survey of the ditch company property to be attached as Exhibit 3 to the easement agreement. The third thing that we're asking for is that this court direct the defendants to provide a key to Mr. Long to go through the locked gate that's about 20 feet west of his northeastern property boundary. And the fourth thing that we're asking this court to do is uphold the trial court's finding that it was not appropriate to reform paragraph 2K of the easement agreement because that part of the agreement reflected the intent of the parties. There was no mutual mistake of fact, and there was no unilateral mistake of fact accompanied by inequitable conduct.
You know, so let me ask you a threshold question right off the bat about your issue number one, the extent of the easement. Both sides have characterized that as an issue of contract interpretation, question of law. You obviously take opposing views on that. Is it really a matter of contract interpretation, or is this just a situation where there's no meeting of the minds? There's no contract because you haven't agreed on something that's central to what your dispute was about. Can you help me with that?
I think it's a matter of contract interpretation. What the trial court found was that the easement didn't extend beyond the northeast part of Mr. Long's property. And it made that finding predominantly because the ditch company was not identified as a grantor under the easement agreement. Under the rules of contract interpretation, the agreement and any supporting agreements have to be interpreted as a whole. There are more than 20 different provisions in five separate agreements that address the location of the easement. And there are two purposes for the easement. The first is that the easement encumber all of Monarch Road in Section 35. And the second purpose is to provide access to the ditch company property.
In your briefs, you, at least indirectly, take issue with the trial court because the trial court didn't make a finding of ambiguity on this particular issue. If this panel were to find that there was ambiguity here on this issue, would you agree that the proper remedy is to send it back for a full evidentiary hearing on that issue before the trial court?
If there is a finding of ambiguity, basically the way that the case was structured was like a summary judgment motion, and that's the proper remedy, is to go back for an evidentiary hearing if there's a finding of ambiguity. I don't think the location of the easement is ambiguous.
I understand your argument. Okay, thank you.
With respect to your third point, the locked gate, can you describe for me the extent of property owned as opposed to possibly having easement rights by Mr. Long from the gate to the reservoir? In other words, is it 10 feet wide? Is it 2 feet wide?
It is
about.
It's about maybe 150 square feet of property. I think it's about 10 by 15, something along those lines.
But is it rectangular or is it a long strip?
It's a rectangular piece that where it exists is in between north of Mr. Long's northern fence line, and it's blocked off by the gate on the west side, and it's blocked by his northern fence line on the south side.
If the gate weren't there, does he own enough property to drive a vehicle across the boundary or through the gate, turn it around, and come back without going on somebody else's property?
I think he would have, the way that the gate is positioned right now, he would have to go on the easement on Julius Valentine Senior's property to be able to access that property.
Where in the record, if at all, does it show that the width of this slice of his own property between the gate and his, the eastern end of his own property is 10 feet?
The place where you could see that would be in Exhibit L, which is the map that we have here. And what it shows is both the location of the fence that's on Mr. Long's northern boundary, and then it also shows the new boundary that at the closing will become Mr. Long's northern boundary.
How do we know it's 10 feet as opposed to 2 feet or 3 feet? What?
The exact size of the parcel is not identified in the record. And what's...
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Bertinos, what is Mr. Long's interest in having the easement defined as extending 83 feet east of his property? Because from the briefs, I gather that he concedes that he has no right to go onto the ditch company property. And the only thing that I read in your briefs that showed that he would have an interest at all in that 83 feet was in driving a snowplow or turning around the snowplow so he could clear the road near his property.
They're both practical and legal issues that are involved in your question. With respect to the practical, is that where the gate is located, he has needs the ability to continue to the east.
Well, I'm not asking about the gate. I'm asking about the extension of the easement from the end of his property to the beginning of the ditch company property.
And the purpose of the easement isn't something that is, the extension isn't something that's isolated to Mr. Long. Because there are multiple parties that are served by the easement, when it was set up, there were two different easements that were contemplated by the parties. The second easement is identified in paragraph F1H. And what that easement does is it goes over the East Bridge, the North Valentine Road, and the West Bridge. The second easement was intended to go from the western boundary of Section 35 all the way to the ditch company property. And in order for this easement to work, the entire width of Monarch Road from the entirety of Monarch Road in Section 35 has to be part of the easement. If it stops short, the easement doesn't work.
But if he doesn't have any right to use the easement to access the ditch company property, how does he have standing to quarrel with whether or not the easement extends this 80 foot?
I think that goes to the defendants. One of the defendants' points is they said that the definition of road in the easement agreement was different than the definition of the road in the settlement agreement. And that one of the best places to look for the answer to that question is in the amended permanent injunction order, which is Exhibit 5 to the settlement agreement. In paragraphs 4 and 5 of that order, it outlines what the parties were intending to do, and it makes it clear that the easement was intended to encumber all of the road. And the defendants under paragraph 2F of the easement agreement provided Mr. Long with set purposes for which he could use it. It may be that he doesn't go to the ditch company property, but they gave him that right. That was part of the agreement. Their subjective intent in doing that isn't relevant to this court's analysis. What's relevant is the plain language of 2F. And what they did was give him the right to go there. And it's not the role of this court to look at what the parties were intending subjectively.
Well, how do you square that argument with the trial court's ruling? Because it appears to be undisputed in the record that if you go past Mr. Long's eastern border of his own property, that there is property owned by the ditch company within the 20 feet of the easement. And so if that's the case, why doesn't the easement was intended to go on that far, why doesn't the ditch company have to be a grantor? Because otherwise, how's anybody, Mr. Van Thine, Long, or anybody, going to be able to go on that property?
There are two points that I'd like to raise in response to that question. The first is that in Recital E of the easement agreement, what the parties wrote is that all of the road is on Mr. Long's property and Julius Valentine Sr.'s property. And that the historic access point for the ditch company property is about 80 feet east of Mr. Long's property. It's physically impossible to access the ditch company property from the northeast boundary of Mr. Long's property. The historic entry point for the ditch company is 83 feet east, and that's why it has to be there. The second issue is that even if the ditch company is a grantor, that doesn't render the easement as a whole as a nullity. What it does is it means that that part of the easement is not effective.
But it doesn't say that in the agreement. I mean, it says the easement's 20 feet wide, and under any of these plats, even the one that you like the best, it shows that there's a sliver of land that's owned by the ditch company that's within the 20 feet. So how do we deal with that?
The way that you deal with that is that the easement, part of the easement may be on the ditch company property. The road is not. And that's a very important point. And the reason that it's an important point is because when you look at what the parties were intending, they wanted to provide access to the ditch company property. There are at least five different provisions of the easement that are contingent upon access being provided to the ditch company property. And the place where that has happened historically was at a point 83 feet east of Mr. Long's property. And so what it may do is that there may be a portion, southern portion of the easement that where the ditch company isn't a grantor, but it doesn't need an easement to go over its own property. The second issue is whether or not the ditch company has to prepare a survey of its property. And what the trial court found was that the settlement agreement didn't contemplate that the ditch company would have to survey its property to attach as Exhibit 3, to prepare a legal description to attach as Exhibit 3 to the easement agreement. That conflicts with the plain language of paragraph E3 of the settlement agreement. It conflicts with the easement agreement.
And what plain language are you talking about?
The first two sentences of paragraph E3 impose requirements on Mr. Long and on the ditch company. The first words say, Mr. Long shall be responsible for preparing Exhibit 1 and Exhibit 4 at his expense. There is no dispute that that language refers to the preparation of a legal description. The defendants are asking this court to take the same words and apply a different interpretation to them, because the second sentence says, the defendant shall be responsible for preparing Exhibit 3 at their expense.
And when you go to the easement agreement, it talks about Exhibit 3, that the property is to be more particularly described in Exhibit 3. So where is the language regarding either survey or a legal description, which presumably, I guess, means something by meets and bounds, anywhere in the plain language of the requirement that's imposed on the ditch company?
What, for clarification, one of the best places to look is on page 2 of hearing Exhibit 10. That was a checklist that the parties developed before they executed the settlement agreement. Subparagraph 2.3 is entitled Legal Descriptions, and 2E3 identifies the ditch company legal description to be prepared after the boundary agreement is finalized. I'd like to reserve the remaining 2 minutes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Patinos.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Ronald Young appearing on behalf of all of the defendants, and present at the table are Ted Bendelow, Meredith McDonald, and Nikolai Franz is also present. We couldn't get too many lawyers in front of you today. I'm ready to begin if you're ready to start the clock. Thank you. Perhaps the most important issue to start with in this matter is this issue of Long's attempt to extend the easement to the east by some 83 feet, and I'm going to refer to this issue as the easement extension issue. Resolving this issue is relevant to other issues in this matter because it will demonstrate the party's intent in this agreement. So it will be relevant to the reformation issue, the gate issue, the contempt issue, and the attorney's fee issue. Long's admissions in this case, in pleadings, in the record, are most important here. He admits he has no right to be on ditch company property. The court has already noted that. He also admits that he has no access to anything east of his property, and I can cite in the record if you need me to for any of these points. He admits, to your point, Your Honor, that at least 1 foot of the road east of the Leggett ditch is on ditch company property, and that's at page 33 of his opening brief. And so I would tender that it is not accurate to say that the road is not on ditch company property, that only the easement is, because if you look at the surveys, and you can possibly see from that distance, you'll see that this gray part here is on ditch company property. And so again, they've admitted that at page 33 of their brief.
Mr. Chung, excuse me for interrupting. Who does own the property that's on that 83 feet that's in dispute?
That's owned by the ditch company that's at issue in this case, the party in this case. It used to be many ditch companies. We've just had consolidated, right. So I refer to them as the ditch company. And Mr. Vantine Sr. So that property boundary, and another thing to keep in mind is that Mr. Long's this wouldn't even be an issue but for the fact that the settlement agreement is giving him an extension up into this easement. So he's gaining property he never had before, and that's the only part that is concerning to him that's beyond this gate, which is right here.
Do you agree with opposing counsel's characterization of it? It's about 150 square foot, you know, 10 by 12, 10 by 15?
I believe it's about 6 by 16, but that's correct. It's not necessarily measured on this exhibit, but I think that's about accurate.
And what is your response to Mr. Long's contention that he needs to have at least access to some part of this easement extension for road maintenance or clearing snow?
Are you referring to the what he's claiming beyond his property?
Yes, I am.
He has no reason ever to be on that part of the property. I don't think it's part of the easement.
Well, he said in his brief that if he wants to clear snow on the part that's to the west of that 83 feet, that is his property, and he needs to turn around the snow plow, then he would go on to the part that's in dispute.
What he's suggesting then is that he's going to move snow from the easement that he's legitimately on, and that he needs the ability to move it past his property onto ditch company property. So what is he going to do? Is he going to move the snow down here, up here? Anywhere he moves it, it's going to be on somebody else's property. He doesn't have the right to trespass like that. If he wants to move snow, which he has a right to do under the easement, he can move it onto his property, which is what's going to have to happen, because north of the property is the ditch. So that's exactly what's going to happen, and it's the width of the easement being 20 feet allows turnaround. That's why we made it 20 feet, because 12 feet isn't going to be adequate to maintain the easement. So we made it 20 feet wide so people can plow snow, move, grade the road, that kind of thing. There's absolutely no reason for him to be beyond his property over here. There never has been.
And yet the agreement doesn't get that specific. It gives both him, Vantine Sr., and the ditch company the right, and I guess maybe the obligation, I'm not even sure about that, to do this kind of snow removal and maintenance. So are they going to be out there competing with each other with snow plows on who's going to take the snow off? I mean, the agreement doesn't tell us that.
Right, Your Honor, and as you can imagine, negotiating this agreement was no easy chore. All the parties wanted the right to be able to maintain the easement, and again, when I talk about the easement, I'm ending it here. I'm not referring to this extension portion. All of the parties want the ability to go in and move the snow if they need to.
Doesn't that relate to the locked gate issue? Because if he has a right, or it's a reasonable expectation that he can at least push snow along the easement up to his property line, he can't do that with the gate lock. Correct?
You're correct.
Okay, well, why doesn't that essentially end? Why doesn't that resolve a locked gate issue adversely to your interests?
Because he doesn't necessarily need to move this snow over this 6 by 16 piece of property that is his. There's no reason for him to be doing that. Our parties can do that. The gate has been there historically. It's admitted that it's been locked historically. It was recognized in the agreements as not being a hindrance or an interference to the easement.
Let's talk about that for a minute. The plain language of that provision says it's deemed not to be a unreasonable interference with respect to grantees, but as to his property, he's not a grantee. He's a grantor. He owns it. So you can't use, as the trial court did, that provision to say Mr. Long loses on that account. Don't you have to get into issues of reasonableness? And if so, isn't that a question of fact under the law?
Respectfully, I would disagree with that interpretation. I think that the Servient estate, the dominant estate, which are the grantees in this instance, would have a duty to the grantor to not unreasonably expand the use of the easement or interfere with the grantor's use, which I would propose was contemplated at the time that this was entered into.
That's not what the agreement says. That sentence that the trial court relied on and that the parties talk about in their briefs is limited to grantees. It says nothing about grantors. And with respect to this sliver of property that Mr. Long owns on the south side, he owns it. So why does the fact that there's been an existing structure there matter at all? Don't you simply have to decide based on lazy dog whether it's reasonable or not to keep him out by not giving him a key?
Well, I think I would submit that he's both a grantor and grantee, and that the language in the agreement just says that it's not an unreasonable interference in the use of the easement. What this is taken outside of the lazy dog context because it's actually contemplated in the agreement that the gate existed. There's no dispute that it's always been locked. There is a new gate on this end of the property, the west gate. There was a provision in the agreement to allow give Mr. Long a key to that. So certainly it's contemplated that where there's a gate that's going to be locked, who's going to get keys to it? That was contemplated. So
Mr. John, I don't recall reading anywhere in the briefs anything about how if having not giving Mr. Long a key is reasonable, under what circumstances that he would be able to obtain a key to open the gate, or whether in the alternative it was contemplated that he would never go beyond the gate. Is there anything in the record that speaks to those issues?
There is in the record and at the trial court, it was mentioned in the briefs that the parties had offered to move the gate to over here to the edge of the property, and that was declined. I don't have the citation in the record.
But I remember reading that, but that doesn't, I don't think that answers my question.
Perhaps I mean, I didn't understand it.
Briefs repeatedly talk about how the access to an easement cannot be unreasonably denied. So if Mr. Long does not have a key, was it contemplated that he would never have a need to go beyond the gate, or that if he does need to go beyond the gate, that all he had to do is call somebody from the ditch company and they would come right over and give him a key or open the gate for him?
He has access to this piece of property through a space in his fence. He doesn't have vehicular access to the property, but he has access to the property. Keep in mind, this piece of property was given to Mr. Long to resolve a disputed boundary. So there's not really much he's going to be able to do with this piece of property, but it was given to him so that it would be clear that it's not Mr. Vantine Sr.'s property and it's not the ditch company's property. So it was more of an issue of, all right, because the court may not know, but the underlying action prior to the first appeal, it was Mr. Long's position that his property boundary extended up above the road. So this originally started out as a property boundary issue, There was a compromise that led to this settlement agreement whereby the defendants agreed to extend his boundary all the way up to Mr. Vantine Sr.'s boundary, and that unfortunately extends all the way out to here. We actually agreed as part of the settlement to just draw a straight line up to this corner from his existing corner in order to resolve the boundary. The issue of accessing the 6x16 triangle was never really an issue.
But it is now. He owns the property.
He will.
So how do you determine whether the failure to give him a key is reasonable or not?
I think it's because he accepted it. He accepted in the agreement that the gate existed and it was locked. He accepted that he had pedestrian access and that the fence was going to remain, his fence is going to remain. So he accepted those conditions because that's what they were at the time. Moving back to the agreements themselves, because I think it's important to talk about on this issue of where the easement ends. It's not just the recital, and if you look at the trial court's order, the court points out that they took the documents as a whole in looking at the party's intent. And the one point, I notice my time is getting low, so I'm not going to go through all of them, but there are provisions in the grant of easement, in the easement agreement, not just in the recital, but in paragraph 2F that counsel spoke of, that specifically states what Long's uses for the easement are, and they're to access his property, not property beyond his property. The point that the court pointed out, which I think is important and doesn't come out in the briefs when I reread them, is that this issue where counsel has tried to say that there was this modification through correspondence between counsel and then counsel changed their mind or something like that is not the case, because if you look at the motion for contempt citation, Long's counsel actually admits and acknowledges that because the ditch company is not a grantor, that our reason, the defendant's reason for not wanting to enter into this easement agreement at the time, therefore they wanted us held in contempt, was because we were concerned about this extension issue. They say in the motion for contempt that, and the site for that is in the supplemental CD record, it starts at 5319, but page 5323 is the pertinent portion. And that actually states in their motion, rather they have chosen not to enter into the agreement because of a fear that, one, an alleged ambiguity might be misinterpreted by someone not familiar with the agreement, and two, the agreement could be construed as providing Mr. Long with access to the Boulder and White Rock ditch and reservoir property. As a matter of law, Long's counsel says, this problem does not exist. The Boulder and White Rock ditch and reservoir property is not a grantor under the easement agreement. It goes on. But they're acknowledging in their efforts to have us held in contempt that that is a valid argument, that you can't have an extension without the ditch company being a party to it because of this 2 feet or 1 foot within the road that they've admitted to.
Your time is short, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to ask you a question about the reformation issue.
Okay.
Why isn't that claim barred by Section L1 of the final release and settlement agreement? Your own motion said it was a motion to modify, and the remedy that you were asking for was reformation. So why doesn't the analysis stop there?
Well, I think that the district court, first of all, reading that paragraph that you talked about, that's going to prevent modifying the terms, the meaning of the terms. And we're not suggesting that what we wanted to do would modify the meaning of the agreement. We wanted to clarify the agreement so that it followed the party's intent under a mutual mistake.
But the provision L1 says even if there's a mistake, there's not going to be a modification. That's what we all agree to.
But it says if there was a mistake about the terms.
Actually, it doesn't.
Okay. And my time's up, but, yeah. But thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Patinos, if you're still there.
I'm still here.
You have a minute and 56 seconds.
Thank you. The first point on the reformation issue, we believe that that claim is barred by paragraph L1. Even if that paragraph doesn't apply, there's no mutual mistake of fact in reducing the agreement to writing, and there was no inequitable conduct because all parties were represented by counsel. And there's never been a court that's held that the potential for a possible ambiguity is a proper basis for reforming an agreement. The second point that I wanted to make is that in the motion for contempt, the point that we were making is not that the easement was ineffective because the ditch company was not a grantor. It's that the ditch company didn't grant anything to Mr. Long. And that's a distinction that that Mr. Young didn't make.
Let me follow through on that. When you outlined the issues that were before us, you didn't say that the court's ruling on the motion for contempt was before us, and yet that's argued in the brief. So is that something that you're still pursuing or not?
There are two additional. We believe that in our brief, we did ask that the defendants be directed to sign the easement agreement that was attached, and that they be directed to. So the contempt is still before the court, as is the request for attorney fees.
Thank you.
A second issue is that one of the things when a court is interpreting a contract, it can do is look at the conduct of the parties from the time that the agreement was signed until the point before there was a dispute. That comes out of the Town of Estes Park water rights case. The April 1st letter that the defendants sent to Mr. Long's counsel highlights an important point on that issue. Our surveyor made a mistake in preparing the legal description for the easement agreement. I raised that issue with defendants' counsel, and we reached an agreement on how to solve that problem. And that involved, and the defendants agreed to send their surveyor out to survey the last 83 feet. They agreed to take the calls for that legal description, add them to the legal description that our surveyor had prepared so that the easement legal description could be finalized. That conduct is inconsistent with the position that the defendants have taken in their appeal, and they haven't explained the difference between their April 1st letter and the position that they've taken in their briefs.
Mr. Bertino, your time is up unless my colleagues have any additional questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bertino. Thank you, Mr. Jung, and your co-counsel for their presence this afternoon. We appreciate very much your arguments on this case. That concludes the oral arguments this afternoon for Division 1. The court will be in recess, and the bailiff may so announce.